Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 210, Right Livelihood, Buddha in the Workplace.
Hello, everybody. I'm so happy to talk to you again. And I want to talk today about right livelihood. I have a book coming out. It's going to be called Buddhas Have More Fun. And I'm enjoying that because actually, if you look in a book called The Secret Language of Birthdays, you will see that my birthday, August 3rd, is called The Day of the Dangerous Quest. And it shows that people born on my birthday. Now, President Obama was born on August 4th. And he's another, you know, death-defying Leo, like me, but he's more into the vision. And ironically, he's a little sort of hesitant about activism, actually, which can explain some of his manifestations, as president, where he didn't follow through on certain things that he wanted to, but he overthought it maybe, and he didn't really do it. And therefore, everything got undone at the end of his, because he didn't like confrontation. And he didn't want to face the fact that the Republicans were simply blocking everything he did. And so he kept calling for bipartisanship with them, but that was in vain, you know. And then they immediately took advantage of that. And actually, more kind and compassionate and more energetic would have been to take them at their word and call them out all the time. Imagine, he's such a great orator, Obama, and he's such a wonderful person. If he had gone out in Air Force One himself and had done rallies all over the country like this crazy guy is nowadays, in other words, kept campaigning against the do-nothing Senate and House, Ryan and McConnell, would have been very different what he could have accomplished in his time. Really, because I think people would have really rallied around him, but he sort of disappeared into like isolation, and I'm just home with my fam, and I can't deal with those people who are just blocking me, and I'll do some stuff by executive orders, but I don't know. And meanwhile, I don't really want to save the Syrian people because it's quagmire, and never mind the Russians. You know what I mean? Because that's August 4th, anyway, that's all I'm saying. August 3rd is the day of the dangerous quest, and I have to be cautious myself in that kind of a situation that I don't undertake things because they're impossible. I like to do impossible things, but I insist on getting them done. So to use the expression fun with the Buddha is a little bit of a shock to people, I think. You know, you can kind of get away with joy, the joy of nirvana, happiness. You can do the art of happiness. You can do... Even bliss is scary, because when people say bliss, they think either saintliness or sexuality. And both of them are kind of scary to people. And, you know, it's either Jesus or Mary Magdalene, one or the other. But point is, I'm talking bliss, I'm talking fun, I'm talking happiness, I'm talking joy, I'm talking relief, I'm talking pleasure even. I'm talking orgasm. So Buddhas Have More Fun is the title. And in that I have, I use the basic pattern of the Eightfold Path, which is the Fourth Noble Truth. And I explain a lot about the Four Noble Truths, but I don't make it a thing about Buddhism. I make it a thing about Buddhism. In fact, I coined that word. to my own shock. It shocked me when it happened. And then even another word I coined is the four nobler truths. And in that I was referring to some teachings in the Mahayana, where he contradicts the four noble truths. Buddha himself does. He talks about permanence, eternity of the Buddha presence. He talks about, even though the body is changed, the presence is eternal. You know, Dharmakaya, reality body, you could call it. He talks about bliss rather than suffering. He talks about purity rather than impurity. And he insists that nirvana is the true reality, which he already implies in the Four Noble Truths, but he just makes it explicit. So explicit even that his top disciple, Shariputra, in the Lotus Sutra, admits when he comes back to listen to it, he kind of runs away. And then he comes back and he admits that he ran away because when he heard the Buddha contradicting the Four Noble Truths, he thought it wasn't Buddha, it was Mara the devil impersonating Buddha and giving a teaching contradicting the Four Noble Truths. And he said that that's terrible. And then he thought it was terrible and he ran away, he thought Buddha was the devil. Then he realized the Buddha was Buddha and he realized, gee whiz, this is an opposite new idea for me, new idea for me. And then he kind of gets the idea because he's a saint. And he has a little bit inkling of the bliss of nirvana, Shariputra for sure. And he's a great saint and an arhat, what they call. And but then he says, well, why didn't you tell us right off? If their four nobler truths are the opposite of the four of some of the four noble truths, especially the first two, suffering, the first one actually, suffering. If they're the opposite, then how come you didn't let on earlier? And then the Buddha gives a lot of parables, but his famous parable is the one of the father with the many children and in the burning who are playing in a burning house when they don't know that it's burning. And the father needs to get them out of there quick. And so he says to the children, he knows the children, they're his children. There's no mention of what the mothers are doing during this time, by the way. And since there are many children, it must be many mothers. But that doesn't mention that. But anyway, in this parable, in this, you know, thing. So he says, the father knows what the kids like. So he says to the kids who like deer, he says, I have deer carts for you outside. And you can run around and zoom around in deer carts. And he has other kids, he knows they like horses. And he says, I have horse carts for you outside. You can go in and gallop around with your horse cart. And then he knows a few of them really like bullock carts, you know, big oxen, you know, bullocks. And he says, I have bullock carts for you outside, you know, big bulls. You can drive around big carts pulled by bulls. So then they all rush out pell-mell to get what they want and what they like. But when they get out there, all he has is bullock carts. Doesn't have a deer cart. Doesn't have a horse cart. So then he says to Shariputra, well, technically, you could say that that father lied to those other kids. But he knew they didn't like bullocks and bullock carts. And they would have run out there for the bullock carts. And then they might burn to death in the burning house. So do you think that's an excusable lie? Is it a lie based on a deeper truth of saving these kids? And Shariputra says, well, yes, I guess so, you know. And so, but then, of course, in that parable, he doesn't explain what is the deer cart and what is the horse cart. But commentaries do explain. And the deer cart and the horse cart are these lesser motivations that pull the cart, which is your vehicle of reaching freedom from suffering. And they are lesser motivations, and the deer cart is the disciple or the apostle's motivation. Well, I want to save myself from suffering. And I realize when I am suffering, I lash out and I hurt others. So in a way, I'm saving others from being hurt by me. But I can't really take them with me into freedom from suffering. So I'm only seeking my own way out of the free of suffering by joining the order. That's the deer cart. And then, because they like to get together in a herd. Then the horse cart is the solitary sage Buddha type, what they call, or solitary, the hermit Buddha, I sometimes call it, Pratyeka Buddha. And they don't join any communal order of mendicants, but they say, well, I'm just going to go off by myself in the forest or whatever, and I'm going to like reflect on reality. I'm going to understand the 12 links of dependent origination, the origin of life and the meaning of life, and I'm going to become enlightened, and I can't really take anybody with me, and I can't help them. So those are these lesser motivations. And why they are said to be lesser? Well, they are not wrong motivations, because to save everyone, you have to save yourself along the way, or even maybe even a little bit ahead of time, realistically speaking. Because if you're not saved, you won't be able to save another. You won't be free. You know, you have to be free yourself. So they're all correct motivation in a way, but they're not as strong, because the human being is a very social animal, and you know, they do love their kin, and they do love others. And they do identify with others. They're very compassionate and sympathetic, we human beings. We're not perfect. We can be very aggressive and hostile and murderous even. But we our basic drive is connect, because we need, you know, we nurse at the mother's breast. We're mammals. We're born in the mother's, we take life in the mother's womb. And then we depend on the mother and father and the relatives and other strangers who are total strangers to us at first. We totally depend on them for decades, actually. So we are very, and we know that subliminally, and then others depend on us, and we're like that. So when we're doing it for us and everyone simultaneously, the motivation is much more powerful. It's like the man in the ancient story of Marathon of Athens, or the first marathoner who ran from the Marathon Pass all the way to Athens to warn the Athenians that the Persians were going to come and waste them if they didn't defend themselves and get ready and so on. And he ran past the ability of his body. So the minute he delivered the message to the Athenians, he collapsed, because he was so empowered by his wish to save his community, his family and larger family, his nation, that he sacrificed his own health. And he had a brain hemorrhage or whatever, collapsed and died. Heartburst, however they describe it. So this is a known phenomenon, that heroes and heroines, you know, mothers will die for their young and so forth. And this kind of thing is a more powerful motivation for people to achieve the same goal, which is nirvana. And once you really understand what nirvana is, that it is the nature of reality, then you know that you're just, you and others are all interwoven in that reality, and in a way you can't even achieve it fully without bringing everyone with you. It's not possible to fully achieve it, because it's filled with all beings, because nirvana is all of this. That's the non-duality thing, which is the bullock cart and the super motivation of the bodhisattva hero and heroine, okay?
Greetings and salutations, podcast wallas. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This two-part podcast was originally recorded July 2019 at the home of Robert and Nena Thurman in Woodstock, New York. To watch an extended video version of this teaching, be sure to visit the Tibet House US YouTube channel. We'll be premiering this video teaching later on this month, around Professor Thurman's birthday on August 3rd. If you're a Facebook user or already follow Professor Thurman on Facebook as Robert A.F. Thurman, don't miss the special Birthday Facebook Live with Professor Thurman. Tune in, we'll be broadcasting that live birthday message morning of August 3rd. Your online participation with the Bob Thurman podcast helps support Tibet House's mission to present and preserve Tibetan culture. Every like, comment, subscription, and share helps support our work. If you're not already a fan of Robert Thurman and Tibet House US on social media, look for us and we'll follow you back. The Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House US membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including special docet tours around the world led by Professor Thurman and geographic expeditions, please visit the Tibet House website at tibethouse.us. Trips in 2019 include Bhutan. Music for the Bob Thurman podcast is generously supplied by our dear friend Tenzing Chogyal. To learn more about the music and work of Tenzing Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. Special thanks to the Bob Thurman Podcast Poet Laureate Gary Gock for his wonderful reading of poetry at the end of each week's episode. To learn more about the work of Gary Gock, please visit his website at garygock.com. There'll be links in the podcast description, and I encourage you to visit his website to learn more. And now, back to the second half of this week's episode with Professor Thurman digging deeper into right livelihood and how it affects our daily lives. Thanks again for subscribing, and hope to see you in person or online at Tibet House or at Menla soon.
So anyway, right livelihood, that's right livelihood. So now right livelihood, and it's interesting, it comes as a third teaching in the ethics section of the study and the practice and the learning and the practice of the components of the Eightfold Path, which is the way of reaching nirvana, or rather in a Mahayana sense, a way of discovering that nirvana is your reality. It isn't like really you're going somewhere else, you're discovering where you truly are in the non-dual sense. And the first of them being realistic speech, and the second one being realistic ethical action or evolutionary ethical action, karma. And then the third one is livelihood. So in a way, it's a subcategory of realistic evolutionary action, karma, karmic evolution. And there's a preliminary subcategory of that, which is realistic speech, because speech action is action that is realistic or unrealistic, good or bad, leads to a positive outcome or negative outcome. And it's the first one, it's taken out of context and discussed first by Buddha, taught first, because it's the one that helps you learn, because it deals with language. And that's how the human being can learn, using language, even although language is imperfect, and learning doesn't just mean repeating what you heard. Learning means understanding what you hear, and what you hear cannot completely create the understanding. It can only aim you toward understanding. And then you have to sort of go beyond it in a certain way to actually understand. It's like the label of a nice, sweet, good, healthy apple will lead you to pick it up, to acquire it, and to bring it up to your mouth. But to eat it, it won't eat it for you. You have to chomp on it yourself to consume it. You know. So language, that's not a mysterious, like, amazing thing. The eating is not captured completely in the expression like it's good to eat an apple. That just aims you to do it. So speech, therefore, is preliminary. Then evolutionary action is mentioned. And the key to evolutionary action, which I have to mention to discuss evolutionary livelihood, the key to it is that we all are social beings. We are totally interrelated with other beings. There's nothing absolutely separate about us or absolutely alienated or absolutely isolated from everything else. We are totally interwoven with everything else. And therefore, if we are harmful to others, we will harm ourselves because we're connected to the others. And if we're helpful and beneficial to others, then we're helpful and beneficial to ourselves because we are totally interconnected with them. And sometimes it's subtle and nuanced and complicated, but that's the basic principle of it. And therefore, the worst state of all is what's called hell, which is a state of ultimate isolation, where you have no contact with others except some kind of harmful thing, where you are cut or crushed or frozen or burnt or tortured or isolated in whatever way, you know. And so the worst, as you head towards greater and greater isolation from the relationality of all life, the more you suffer. And the opposite is when you completely embrace and identify yourself with all life, you then become a Buddha, and then you don't suffer anymore. You then are free of suffering because you can encompass anything that might seem suffering if you only focus on it within the much more vast nature of life itself, which is blissful. It is happiness. It fits together. You know, this we live, we're alive because we fit in with our environment and with others. And the human is the most interfitting of all the forms. Really. We're totally interfitting. And we really need each other, you know. The gods and the angels are very interfitting too, but in a way they're all so cool. They're more cooled out than we are in a way, although not completely cooled out. And in a way, that more cooled outness of them is a drawback for them, because in a way, they don't need each other. They're very self-sufficient. So then they don't really get the bliss of interconnection with everyone. They can be quite vast in their self-sufficiency. And then this will lead them to the unrealistic view that they're somehow completely separate from others, which leads straight to hell, actually. So they kind of overshoot the interrelated nature of the human thing, and then crash down below them, undershooting it by far, towards the hellish and animalistic and hunger level of life, and then come back to this very delicate, strange middle path, middle place, center of the universe thing, which is the human being. Not because the human being is better than all beings. The gods and angels are actually better than the human. They're more happy, they're more, in a short-term way, they're more happy, they're more intelligent even, and they're more self-sufficient, actually, than the human. But then this leads them into worse situation, and they're not enlightened, and they have very little motivation to try to get enlightened, so they're slow about it. Because the human is all interrelated, but really needing each other, vulnerable to each other, but needing each other. So they can cultivate compassion, and this compassion is what causes them then to break past any kind of tendency or temptation to try to isolate themselves and more embrace and identify with the universe until they feel they are the universe. And then that's when they're really happy, because there's nothing unhappy in their entire experience except their awareness of others' unhappiness. And this is where the more fun comes in. Now, I would never have written Buddhas Have More Fun because I was operating under a refutation by an old friend for the last 45 years, I would say, maybe 50 years. Because that friend said to me, if you have perfect bliss, then it's no fun. Because you're just blissed out and you get bored with bliss. It's like you're just a jar of Vaseline, is how he put it. The universe is a giant jar of Vaseline. There's no friction, so there's no release from sort of stress or tension or anything. So there's no fun. You're just kind of boringly blissful, meaning you don't even know the opposite of it, so it's nothing to you, kind of. You know, so there's no fun. And I couldn't answer that in a way, you know, because it's the change toward relief that is we consider pleasurable in life, right? Ordinarily. Until I got this one. Compassion, you see, is the more fun. And why? We would think, oh, wait, no, compassion is opening up to the grief of others and trying to help them get out of their grief and free them from the grief. So that couldn't be, how could that be fun? You know, tragedy in the Indian dramatic, literary, dramatic sense, you know, aesthetics, compassion is developed in tragedy by observing tragedy. You feel compassionate for the victim of the tragedy, you know. So that couldn't be fun. But actually, this is the key. When you're a Buddha, you are totally blissful. So much so that you don't need any more bliss. So you have no lust, no greed. You're totally contented. And blissed out contented, not just a little bit contented. Fully contented. If orgasm is what biggest bliss in your mind, any of you who are listening, if that might be thought of as the biggest pleasure, then it's like every cell in your body, your fingernails are having orgasmic bliss at all times. So there's no need for any more of it, type of thing, right? So where's the more fun? Well, you get there when you're completely boundaried, unboundaried. You're completely limitless in your sense of being. You identify with everything. You don't do this in some isolated, white, sanitary, stainless steel, you know, white sheet place. You know, you discover that that is the nature of all of this. If you did it in some way of apart from all these, like, things and people and beings, then it would be an insecure nirvana, because it would be a relative nirvana. It would be a place apart. It would be a kind of isolation, actually. End up in a hellish kind of thing. It is everything. You discover everything is the bliss, like that microphone, this plastic, this computer in front of me. Everything is bliss. You discover that. So, but then, since you identify with everyone, you notice that a lot of other beings don't think so. You feel you're them, and you feel yourself being them, that means, which I know that's a little inconceivable. It's like you're a super mega computer CAT scan, where your awareness is a giant cloud, and therefore you're within every other being, and yet you're apart from every other being. So, because you can interpret what they feel like. And so you feel that they are made of the bliss that is the bliss of everything. That is the nirvanic constitution of everything, let's say, which you might call in the teaching the Buddha nature that they have. But you know that they don't realize it. Because you feel yourself not realizing it when you're identifying with them. So then all you're doing is automatically your bliss energy, which is an inexhaustible energy, because it's infinite. Your bliss energy just wants to configure whatever it takes for that being. If it's a medicine, if it's a drug, if it's a drink, if it's a food, if it's a place, if it's clothing, if it's a person, it's a sound, it's a music, what a scent. Whatever it is that makes that being that thinks that they're not happy, that thinks that everything is horrible, that thinks that the universe is against them, begin to discover that they fit with the universe, that the universe loves them, meaning wants them to be happy, and that actually that is their true nature, happiness. And so when they are then therefore in their interwovenness with you, they are having huge fun of relief from their sense of suffering. And since there's limitless numbers of them, you are having more fun than when you were a kind of person who was just trying to have fun for yourself. Because you're actually having all their fun by their being released into nirvana through their own understanding. Because you're non-dual from both their ignorance and their non-understanding. And luckily, their understanding is deeper and more powerful than their ignorance, especially when stimulated by you, by your understanding, which is pure bliss. Do you get it? Now, what I've just described is, of course, indescribable by definition. So, by just repeating what I said, and in my case, I can't even remember what I just said. But too much in detail. I mean, I know the gist. But by repeating it will not do it. What one has to do, the method is therefore for the person is, they have to look at where their dissatisfaction lies. They have to analyze it and investigate it. They have to see what's wrong with me. Why don't I have what I want? What do I need? You know, So in other words, you don't just look for the nirvana. You look for what's not stopping the nirvana. And in that case, actually, a little bit of faith and credibility in the Buddha, and then I'm saying myself too here, although I'm not a Buddha, but I am repeating what they say. And it's a little bit of faith in that so that you sort of begin to feel maybe a little confidence that if you look at what's bugging you, you will discover you can be free of it. Because your deeper nature is freedom from it. So whatever bugs you is not the absolute thing that is going to control you forever. It's not as deep as a deep inner sense of well-being, which after all, if you're alive, if your heart is beating, if your blood is flowing, if your nerves are transmitting signals, if your brain is working, if your eyesight and earsight and tongue and or even any one of them are functioning, then what is enabling them to function, that energy is the bliss, is nirvana. That's nirvana. So they have that nature in themselves. You have it in yourself. So what is it that I'm not satisfied about is what you look at, you investigate, and you see, is it really worth being not satisfied? And then you'll find that all these barriers and obstacles and problems and addictions, you know, mental addictions, emotional addictions, intellectual addictions, these, you know, convictions, weird views, like I'm right and I know what is going on, all this, you know, you'll find that they'll all dissolve under your analysis. And when they dissolve, what happens is what's there is not nothing. What's there is this bliss. You become open to your actual blissful state of aliveness, the blissfulness of your life. Okay, so that's all preliminary to the topic of today, which is realistic livelihood. So therefore, if you get that sort of grand scheme, the grand narrative, because it is a grand narrative, it's the grand vehicle, the Mahayana. That's just great, it's grand. And the grand vehicle is that everything you do should be moving you toward the grandness of the world and of life and of your interconnectedness with everyone. And of course, the greatest grandness is the love of beings for each other. And the grandness is all done based on love. Of course, love meaning the will to happiness of the other, of the beloved. And you can even love, that's a healthy way you can love yourself. Narcissists don't really love themselves because they are just content with an unrealistic sense of themselves. So they're covering over the fact that they're despising themselves, really, and they're really insecure by being narcissists. Whereas if you really love yourself, you're going to allow yourself to be happy. Narcissists will never be satisfied and happy because they're paranoid. You know, really deep down, you know, that's why they then surface-wise act all very vain, you know. But anyway, so this is the thing. And within that, then, you choose your livelihood, and you choose a livelihood that doesn't cause harm to others, you know, that benefits them. And within the different means of livelihood, there are two kind of basic levels of livelihood, in a way. There's livelihood by force, that is taking stuff from other people. The military, in the ancient Indian thing, Buddha was a member of that class, the military class, the dominating class, the ruling class, ruling by force. And in a way, the priests who ruled by ideology and by propaganda and by making people have conviction that they should be dominated by the priests, well, they were really arm, hand in glove. They backed up the military ruling people. So those were the two upper castes, although the military one was actually the upper one, contrary to what the intellectuals try to say, the Brahmins, you know. The military ones were the boss, actually. And that's not as good because it doesn't really, your livelihood does harm others. It suppresses them, you take their things. If you brainwash them with an ideology that makes them believe that you're great, like a priest, then that suppresses their access to reality directly themselves. They think they have to go through you. You convince them that you're the key to the gods or whatever, or you're the key to reality. You become a dominator of that type or a force dominator, but your mental force, that is. You know? So those are bad. But business is actually good. The merchant classes, the artistic, the artisan classes were good. Those are the ones Buddha really supported. They're actually good. Because they exchange things with people, they interact with them, and they get wealth and livelihood by helping others have wealth and livelihood. is the key. Of course, they a little bit negotiate. They try to get maybe a little better deal than the other one or something. They can get a little into that. But basically, everyone gets a deal out of it. And the ones who are really successful are the ones who see to it that the others have a really good deal. Because then they'll be really popular and the other ones will come back and they'll be wanting to reward them. It's sort of, you know, everything in life has a paradoxical element in it, you know. Like in Buddhist, one of the great things, therefore, is to be a doctor, a medical doctor, a healer. But they say if you are motivated as a healer by the wish for fame, status, wealth, and high status, wealth, and fame, then you'll be a lousy doctor because you will be harmful to people because you'll just be wanting them to think you're great. So you're verging over into a sort of dominator level. But if your motive is compassion, that you just want beings to feel better, and you know about things that make them feel bad, because you study that, and then you really have that motive, then ironically, you will be famous because you will help them. You'll be helpful and you'll be a good doctor. You will be wealthy because they'll want to give you things to thank you for and reward you for helping them. And you will have high status because they'll look up to you because you're helpful. So you get those things, but when you're not motivated for them, and you don't get them when you are motivated them for them, you follow me. You get a fake, you can get temporarily a fake status. You can rip people off, overcharge them for their medicines and things, and even keep them sick so they have to buy more medicine. This is like a modern industrial system. It's like that. And you can do that. But in the long run, it'll collapse because you're actually harming them and they'll eventually learn that. Then they'll be really mad at you. Right? So right livelihood, realistic, as they say, right, but realistic livelihood. And it's realistic because it has a long-term good effect for you and for others. So don't kill animals. Don't kill people. Don't harm them. Heal them, benefit them, make things of beauty for them. These are all good livelihoods. And they all lead to greater connection with other people, and they lessen isolation from other people. And so that's the thing, you know. And it's like my friend Mark, who founded this wonderful company. And within the sort of internet world, it was a company that innovated the idea that your success lies in the success of your clients and customers. And so the idea that if you rip them off, you sell them some package of software or any kind of thing that they can't really use. You overcharge them as much as you can for it, they think they need it. And then in the long run, they're not going to like you and you're not going to help them. And in the long run, you'll collapse. Your company will collapse. But if they really get a benefit from you and they do really well themselves and they're able to benefit others, then it becomes a virtuous circle, not a vicious circle. A virtuous cycle, not a vicious cycle. And then there's no limit to your success because you're bringing everybody with you. It's a wonderful thing. And it totally overturned. It hasn't completely done so, but it's on the way to overturning, getting us back to a deeper and more fruitful vision of business and commerce and trade and these sort of things, you know, where everyone benefits, you know, and it's not a zero sum game of you get everything, the other one gets nothing. That was the military thing. You conquer some people and enslave them, and then you get everything, they get nothing. And then that's bad because they'll eventually rebel and they'll kill you. They'll be so upset. And meanwhile, you'll be all paranoid. You won't even enjoy dominating, being the master of all these slaves because you know secretly they're hating you. And you know you feel very paranoid and you have to hire some bodyguards. And then they're usually the ones who'll turn around and kill you because in a way they're also enslaved by you. You get to make them a little more comfortable temporarily. Pay them more to oppress the others for you. But sooner or later, they'll be dissatisfied with what you're paying them. And they'll turn on you, inevitably. That's always how it happens. You know, the bodyguard of Indira Gandhi is the one who assassinated her, etc. You know, that's what happens. So the bodyguards of Kennedy are the ones who eventually killed him, for example. And then pretended some weirdo with a T-shirt 22. Shot him from a far distance. Ha! Big joke if you ever fired one, you know, perfectly impossible. Okay, so that's a realistic livelihood. Be nice, be happy, have fun, follow your bliss. You know, Joseph Campbell, you know, famously said that to Bill Moyers in a famous set of interviews that he did with Joseph Campbell. He said, follow your bliss. And it's never was there better advice, you know. Although there was a terrible New Yorker article I love where some guy had a tin cup in front of a church in a suburb, like a sort of guy who should have maybe been middle-class looking guy. And he was kind of bearded and shabby looking, but he looked like he maybe had some thing. And the sign he wore said, I followed my bliss. Meaning I didn't make any money. So now I'm begging. But that's wrong. If you follow the bliss, you will be taken care of. You will not have a problem because you'll be happy. Once you're happy, you'll automatically make other people happy around you. And then they will help you. And everything we do is successful because we get to get along with each other. Everything that doesn't work out is when we don't get along with each other. That's the key of life, you know. That's the nature of it. So that's realistic livelihood. In a way, realistic livelihood in Buddha's time, because Buddha himself was a very, you know, his society was very wealthy. It was much more wealthy than nowadays in the West, actually. In all our industrial, we think we're so great. But ancient India was the most wealthy country in Eurasia. And people had the best health. There were some poor people and ill people, but basically they were really well off. They had an agricultural surplus where they would support mendicants in large numbers who were just, that was their way of dropping out and becoming, seeking their meaning of life, you know. And they were able to support such people. It's like nowadays we don't support kids on scholarship. They have huge student debt. We think we're wealthy, but we're actually more stingy, and we're feeling more poverty-stricken and deficits and debts and interest payments. And really, we really have arranged ourselves to feel poor all the time. And although, you know, some people compared to others would say we're wealthy, but we don't feel wealthy because we're not generous. And actually, then it's ironic, the more wealthy we actually get, then the less generous we get because we feel there's something wrong with having a little wealth. Whereas the Buddha's world was not like that. And they were able to, so therefore the best livelihood in the Buddha's thing was to be a mendicant, to drop out and not plow and not fight an army and not serve in business and not, if you're a woman, not bear children and not cook and clean and do all the stuff that labor that women do in that patriarchal society. And the best was to drop out and to unfold one's inner sensibility and discover the meaning of life and bring happiness to the world. And that was honored, and you were fed, and you were taken care of and given shelter and clothing. Very simple, but you put it, designed it beautifully with very modest clothing, just a couple of robes, you know, some cloth sewed together. Climate was really good most of the year round. And simple food, and only one meal a day. It's enough to manage very well, be very healthy, but not overeat, not to gain obesity, you know, gain too much weight, and even be vegetarian if that's what people gave you. He really arranged it really well. And so the realistic livelihood was to let others support you. But that only worked in a society where there was a surplus. And others learned from supporting you, and what you gave in exchange actually was your own happiness. And it overflowed to others. So it was your more direct way of becoming happy. That's why they supported your mendicancy. Your mendicancy means eating free food given by others. So that's really cool. But you know, our post-industrial Protestant ethic and all, there's no free lunch and the whole thing, is because we're, you know, it grows out of the relatively poverty-stricken areas of Eurasia, which were Europe, and the deserty business in the Middle East. The more you got away to the west from India, the more poor it became. And the more you went to the east, to jungly in Southeast Asia and very floodplain prone in China, they were also backward compared to India. And India was so wealthy and advanced in its civilization. That's where they started. And now, in a way, it's been shared. The Anglos robbed India massively for hundreds of years. So more wealth was spread to the West. And then we came over here and genocided the native people here and enjoyed the natural wealth of the Americas. So in a way, there's a little bit global wealth if we really shared it properly. There's no reason for anybody to be really poor here, except individual stinginess and the sense of our poverty of even the wealthy people. The millionaires and billionaires feel poor. So then they don't want to share it. They don't want to house the homeless and whatever, you know, some of them. So that's the thing. Thank you.
Welcome to the Bob Thurman Podcast. I'm Gary Gawk. Joy Harjo was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and is a member of the Muscogee Creek Nation. She has commented, "I feel strongly that I have a responsibility to all the sources that I am, to all past and future ancestors, to my home country, to all places that I touch down on and that are myself, to all voices, all women, all of my tribe, all people, all earth, and beyond that to all beginnings and endings." In a strange kind of sense, writing frees me to believe in myself, to be able to speak, to have voice, because I have to. It is my survival. In Praise of Earth by Joy Harjo. We kept on dancing last summer, though the dancing had been called subversive. We weren't alone at the end of this particular world, and knew it wouldn't be the last world, though wars had broken out on all sides. We kept on dancing, and with us were the insects who had gathered at the grounds, in the grasses and in the trees, and with us were the stars, and a few lone planets who had been friends with the Earth for generations. With us were the spirits who wished to honor this beloved Earth in any beautiful manner. And with us at dawn was the sun who took the lead. And then we broke for camp, for stickball, and breakfast. We all needed praise made of the heart's tattoo as it inspired our feet or wings. Someone to admire us despite our tendency to war, to terrible stumbles. So does the red cliff who is the heart broken to the sky. So do the stories who were the first to speak when we arrived. So does the flaming mountain who harbors the guardian spirits who refuse to abandon us. And this earth keeps faithfully to her journey, carrying us around the sun. All of us in our rags and riches, our rages and promises, small talk and suffering. As we go to the store to buy our bread and forget to plant, sing so that we will be nourished in turn as we walk out into the dawn. With our lists of desires that her gifts will fulfill, as she turns our tears into rivers of sweet water, we spiral between dusking and dawn, wake up and sleep in this lush palace of creation, rooted by blood, dreams, and history. We are linked by leaf, fin, and root. When we climb through the sky to each new day, our thoughts are clouds shifting weather within us. When we step out of our minds into ceremonial language, we are humbled and amazed at the sacrifice. Those who forget become the people of stone who guard the entrance to remembering. And the earth keeps up her dancing, and she is neither perfect nor exactly in time. She is one of us, and she loves the dance for what it is. So does the sun who calls the earth beloved and praises her with light. I'm Gary Gawk, and this poetry segment is a part of the Bob Thurman Podcast and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives License. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal. Tashi Gawk.